Hey, this is Derek, and listening to Skepticality, the official audio program of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, May 17th, 2016.
Science!
Welcome back to another episode of Skepticality, the show that brings you news and interviews with authors, researchers, skeptics, and people from all walks of life, the promotion of rationality, critical thought, and science. So, it's been about a year since last I had Dr. Michael Shermer on this show. He happens to be the man in charge of Skeptic Magazine, the very publication that this show is the official program for. Now, a few things have been happening with Dr. Shermer in the past year, so I decided to twist his arm, have him pop back in for an episode. I am here again with Dr. Michael Shermer. It's been over a year since last time I had you on. In fact, last time I had you on was February 17th, 2015, right around your book, The Moral Arc, came out.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. It's been a while.
Yeah. Yeah. And since then, we had the cool In the Year 2525 conference. I haven't talked to you since we did that last year. Was that last year?
Yep, that's right. It was last June.
Actually,
right. And since then, we've introduced the Science Salon for the Skeptic Society. We're doing these in conversations rather than lectures in more intimate setting, a venue, a private home, and we also, since it's a salon, we have adult beverages afterwards with food, and people hang out and talk. So it's kind of fun. It's a different way of communicating science.
You do it so you can, you know, have a drink afterwards.
Absolutely. You
got to
do it.
Yeah, well, you talked about the 2525 conference. I actually looked it up. So it was almost a year to the day. It was May 29th through 31st last year.
Right.
Yeah. So almost a year. So, you know.
And it's all online. People can watch it.
Yeah. And there's some really great...
Skeptic.com.
Yeah. I had a couple of the speakers on the show shortly after it, so...
Yes, yeah. Good.
So they can now go to the website and actually maybe see some of them. Since then, you've had a new-ish book come out?
Oh, well, Skeptic, yeah. It's just a collection of my Scientific American essays. So it's new-old.
Yeah. Just say new-ish.
Yeah, these are, you know, so the first 7 years, six and a half years of my column... 75 columns. I'm up to actually 100, and I just submitted my 185th consecutive monthly column on Charlie Sheen's quack HIV doctor who said he could cure AIDS, cure HIV with goat milk.
I was going to say, did you see him on Dr. Oz?
Yep, Dr. Oz. Well, I first saw him on Bill Maher.
Oh, yeah, where's that too?
Surprised to see him give this guy that kind of
really
attention.
Yeah, well, no, that's to me
have been surprised, but
no, I mean, that's totally his thing. He's against modern medicine, so
yeah. But it turns out, yeah, even Charlie had a turnaround about that, and you know, Dr. Oz kind of set him straight. Well, he appeared on Dr. Oz twice. The first time is sort of an intervention to get him to get back on his the drug cocktail, and then the second time he was on, he did, and his, of course, his HIV levels went back down to undetectable because the drug cocktail actually works.
Yeah, imagine that.
Unlike goat milk, and you know, but this idea that medicine is advanced by these low, you know, wolves working in isolation in their basements, you know, trying different things. It's just not true. I mean, it might have been true centuries ago, but, you know, there's huge teams of medical researchers that figured out the HIV drug cocktail, and, you know, that we have to come to grips with that, you know, the chances of some lone wolf like this guy, you know, non-credentialed, living in Mexico, fiddling around with different wacky ideas, it's not impossible that that something like that could happen. It's just very unlikely.
Yeah, most of the medical low-hanging fruit has mainly been picked, we think.
Yep, for the most part, that's true. So now it just requires money and teams of researchers, for the most part, to get take the next step. So, I've been working on that, and my next book that I'm writing now, I have to turn in at the end of the year, is called Heavens on Earth, and it's about attempts to achieve immortality or perfectibility in either immortality, here on Earth or in heaven, or perfectibility here on Earth, that is, through utopias, which often end up as dystopias. And so it's a little combination of traditional skeptical analysis and debunking of the afterlife and near-death experiences and things like that. But I also really tackle in depth the singularity, the mind uploading, and various scientific attempts to achieve immortality. And it's been quite an interesting journey, because most of these people that I'm dealing with are atheists. So yeah. We're all on the same page. We love science. We're not believers. We don't believe in heaven and hell and all that stuff. But there is still this almost faith-based belief that, we're going to get there in our generation. The singularity, Ray Kurzweil's, mythical point when computers achieve and then surpass human level intelligence, and we get to live forever because of the law of accelerating returns of all technologies and so on. Once you kind of go down that rabbit hole, it feels like religion. Like this is it. It's going to happen in our generation. We're the first and only generation in human history to get to live forever. And this magical date has now been pinpointed at 2045.
All right.
Which will make me 90 years old.
It's possible. So,
I'm telling you, if I die just before this happens and people get to live forever, I'm going to be so pissed.
No, you won't be.
What?
The nice part is you won't be.
Oh no! I just realized you're right.
you take solace in the fact that you won't be pissed.
I kind of love this stuff. It's very interesting because these people are all super pro-science, and we have that in common. But it's just that, they just take too many leaps between steps. If this is true, and then this happens, and then that happens, and then, 12 steps later, we get to live forever. It's like, but wait a minute. each one of those 12 steps is very, very unlikely and highly unknown. If we could just conquer this one little thing having to do with aging. Yeah, but aging isn't one thing. It's, 100 different things that are going on. Okay, then there's 7. No, it's more than 7. and it's, or the mind uploading. I'm not even clear that in the Johnny Depp scenario in Transcendence, that you turn the computer on and the voice comes out and he's in there. I'm not even sure that would happen, that it would just be a copy and you'd just be dead. You wouldn't even know that this was continuing. So there's problems of identity that I have to deal with. What does it mean to be you? Who are you really? And, so even if you duplicated a perfect copy of you, including a body, say in a clone, how would that be different than a twin? We know about twins, and twins don't confuse themselves with each other. They act and feel like individuals, separate autonomous beings. So wouldn't it just be that? And so when you finally died and your copy kept going, so what? We are already doing that in the form of twins in that sense. And
well, I guess the argument would be the fact that if you somehow uploaded your memories and brain to your copy, then you wouldn't know the difference.
That's right. Yeah, you wouldn't. Well, presumably you wouldn't. Correct.
My question is, how they're going to, because we've since learned many weird things about how our brains interface with our bodies, like the gut flora actually affects your brain. So, there's so many things we found out that actually affect how you work in mentally that you never know. I mean, like I said, it's a lot of leaps.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a couple of dozen neural units at Alcor in Arizona. You know, just the heads are frozen.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge mistake. I mean, assuming it could ever work, which I doubt. But even if it could, you can't have a brain in a jar. You'd have to clone a body and stick it in there somehow, which complicates it. I realize it's cheaper. It's $80,000 for just your head versus, I forget what it is, like $200,000 for the full body. So it's expensive, but, you know, they buy insurance policies, and the beneficiary is Alcor.
Yeah.
So it's the insurance policy that pays for it. So it's not that expensive. You know, so why not go for the whole thing? And the reason is what you just said. You know, a brain in a vat is not the same as a brain in a body because of all the stuff that's going on in our bodies that are part of our who we are.
Yeah. Especially when I learned about some of the, I mean, of course, this is in mice, but they found out that the gut bacteria in mice actually can totally affect how those mice act.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I've seen that study.
Yeah. So to me, this is brain in the jar, I don't think is going to be good enough.
No. Yeah, so that's been interesting. Also, reading about utopias and all the attempts to achieve a perfect society here on Earth, a heavens on Earth, in that sense of the phrase. And what they always fail. You know, yeah. It's just human behavior and human nature is too complex and messy to have a perfect society. But, you know, but what I'm writing about is why people believe that. You know, they think they can get there. And then all the attempts at, you know, all the scenarios of dystopia. We have this fascination of the decline of the West, the decline of society. And, you know, you can hear it in the political rhetoric of this year's election, but it's the same every year. You know, America's going to hell in a handbasket. It's all over. It's, you know, unless you elect us, in which case things will be great again.
Yeah. Well, I remember when my great grandmother, she kept everything and she lived until she was quite old. And I loved talking to her. And her father or grandfather kept a bunch of stuff from the Lincoln election.
Oh, wow.
And she had one of the dolls because so many people were against Lincoln that they actually used to burn effigies of him that they hung from trees. So, when people try to tell me that this election is so much worse than the old ones, like, no, actually, look in the past, it's actually a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, even like if you look at the election, the second election, well, no, the first, I guess it'd be the first presidential election, Jefferson and Jefferson and Adams, and how nasty it was.
Oh yeah,
accusations of infidelity and atheism, and pretty much as nasty as anything that Trump has ever come up with.
Oh yeah,
probably worse actually. And you know, it's just our memories are short on this. You know, I still hear people saying they're going to move to Canada if X is elected. You know, it's like I've been hearing this since, you know, I started voting for Nixon. You know, and back in when Nixon won in '72, this is the first time I could vote. You know, people were saying, "Well, if he's elected, I'm moving to Canada." I've never known anyone that actually moved to Canada.
True. Thinking about that, yeah, I don't think anybody has. Even high profile people have said that, and they didn't do it. So.
Anyway, so that's what I've been working on. You know, what people think about when they're facing death, you know, what that means and how that changes people, not just near-death experiences, but I found an interesting data set I've been analyzing of the last final statements made by Texas death row inmates.
Oh, interesting.
Texas has executed 514 inmates since 1982.
That's disgusting.
I know, when they began recording. And, you know, these guys are strapped to the gurney with the needles in their arms, and they lower a microphone and say, "Well, is there anything you'd like to say?" And you know, but about four-fifths of them did. They had something to say, and they recorded, and they're all on a webpage at the Texas death row, whatever, state of Texas Judicial Department, Justice Department. And they're pretty interesting to read what these guys have to say. Of course, they've had plenty of time to reflect because they've been on death row for decades. But
yeah.
So I present all my findings there on that. It's very interesting. The death row, by the way, following up on the moral arc, looking more and more like it's going to go extinct. There was an article in the paper yesterday about how the major drug companies in America are no longer going to manufacture and sell the drugs that they use to kill people. So it's harder and harder for states to even get the drugs. So the whole thing may just fall apart just for practical reasons. And there's really only four states left that do it with any regularity. I mentioned Texas, Florida, Oklahoma, and Ohio. And if you take those out of the mix, we're executing very, very few people. We're not down to zero like Europe. I mean, to be in the European Union, you cannot have the death penalty. If you have the death penalty, you can't be in the European Union. So that pretty much closed the deal for them. But I think we'll get there by 2025 to 2030. There'll be no more death penalty in America.
Well, I know the few times that I've been here in Georgia, when somebody's come up for the death penalty, like when they actually are going to kill somebody, almost every time there's mass protests.
Yep. It's when you actually read the crimes that these guys did, they're pretty brutal. There's no sympathy for what they did.
No.
It's just that the state makes too many errors and it's just barbaric. It's medieval. It's just not part of the modern world anymore. Yeah. And if you care about this, it's a lot cheaper to keep them on in jail in the regular general population than it is on death row. It's something like 4 or 5 times the cost.
Yeah, I know. I've used that argument a couple times to people and they didn't believe that, and they looked it up. It's like, okay, if that's true, then I understand why we do it.
It's just ridiculously expensive, and all the appeals process costs money.
It clogs up the court. The whole thing baffles me, and I've always been against removing information from the world.
Right.
I mean, you can study these people. I mean, other than, why not, instead of killing them, allow them to be guinea pigs if they desire to? I mean, something. We had better ways to deal with this.
I like that idea. Yeah, the brain scans that a couple of these neuroscientists are doing, where they scan the brains of serial killers, for example, just to see what, and there are differences. Their prefrontal cortex is basically shut down. They have no self-control. They're just, super impulsive. Well, that tells us something about the brain and how it works. That's important.
Yeah. I just don't understand it. I mean, the only thing is, it is just a sense of revenge. That's all it is.
Yes, it's definitely a part of the retributive justice system we've had for thousands of years. And, as I wrote in The Moral Arc, it's understandable why we have it. It's our deep emotional sense of justice and revenge and striking back. And, that's part of our nature. But part of the point of being civilized is to overcome your nature.
we've gone past a little bit of the throwing rotten fruit at the guy as he's walking up to the axe man at the town square.
Yeah, exactly. We've already reined in our impulses in so many other areas. And, I'm sympathetic to the families of victims that have been murdered, people that have been murdered. But that doesn't mean that, we should continue the murdering process.
I've read some studies on the families after the guilty person's been executed, and they don't feel any sense of relief of it. So even that kind of.
Yeah, right. It doesn't do what people think it's going to do. That is, sort of settle the score.
Yeah.
It doesn't do that. And nor is it a deterrence, because most crimes, about 9/10 of homicides, are moralistic in nature. That is, they're impulsive. The guy dissed me, he embarrassed me, he scratched my car, he stole my woman, she slept around on me, he lied to me, he cheated, he embezzled. It's mostly these men. You look at Texas death row inmate, there were, I said, there were 514 executions, only 3 women.
Yeah.
That alone tells us something.
Testosterone, that's what it tells us.
Yes, exactly. Very impulsive. And so it's not like it's a rational calculation where they think, okay, I can rob the liquor store, or I can go over and settle the score with this guy that pissed me off, or I might get executed in 30 years on death row. Well, I better not do it.
Yeah.
You know, they don't think like that. These people aren't thinking at all. They're very impulsive.
Well, if you look at what they have, those like even like some YouTube and Instagram, they have so many people who catch criminals that just take pictures of stuff because they're not thinking. I mean, if you're trying to tell me this is a deterrent, then why are they posting videos and pictures of this stuff to get caught? Right. If these people are getting you thinking about this rationally, like you think they are, they're not.
Right.
We have too much evidence to show that when they're in the middle of that mindset, they're not thinking that way.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we talked a little bit about the election, and you are a well-known libertarian. So tell me something. Why haven't the libertarians take over the fact that everything's a mess on both parties right now? Come on. Seriously.
I don't really know. I mean, the libertarians have always had the problem of not wanting to be part of a big political process, which is why they're libertarians in the first place.
Yeah, well, sometimes you have to, like, set some things around. Some point, you have to get at the table.
I mean, it looks like the libertarian candidate will probably be Gary Johnson, the former,
again, yeah.
Governor of New Mexico.
New Mexico. Yeah.
And he's pretty reasonable, but, you know, they're going to win. You know, I'm predicting it'll probably be Hillary/Bernie. I think Bernie will probably end up being her VP. It's the best chance she has of winning against, you know, Trump. And so, you know, in the Clinton machine, I have a feeling Trump's not going to win. And the Clinton machine is pretty powerful, so...
Yeah, a lot of people still have a fondness for Bill, and even though I'm the side of Frank Zappa still, and the fact that they just still don't like Hillary for the same reasons he didn't, because she hasn't changed very much, so... You know, he used to call her the
Frank Zappa. I didn't know that.
Okay. No, you don't remember that? Frank Zappa, remember all the speeches he gave about, you know, the bored housewives of the White House and all the crazy stuff that Hillary and Tipper used to do?
Oh, right.
Yeah, I mean, we have labels on a lot of stuff now because of them.
Oh, right.
People forget that, you know, the reason we have labels on records is because of Hillary. People forget these things.
That's right. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Forgot about that.
Yeah, a lot of people forget all that stuff and they don't talk about it. So.
Yeah, I mean, politics, it's not really my thing. I just sort of follow it out of interest, but I'm not a big political animal like some people. And, you know, I guess the thing I'm up in arms about these days is the political correctness movement on college campuses that has gotten out of control.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe you might think otherwise, but I've wondered if that's a pushback against the rise up of things like atheism and of more scientific thinking, and it's a way to wedge in more of that educational freedom type mindset. It just seems to be in that same camp of bad ideas.
You mean along the lines of the culture wars in the 90s, where, you know, sort of postmodern science is just another way of thinking?
Yeah.
No better than any other form.
Exactly.
It could have something to do with that. I hadn't really thought of that. I was thinking more of a backlash against, you know, the left going too far left, and that the pendulum always kind of swings back and forth, and there's correctives. Too far on the right, correctives back to the center. Too far on the left, correctives back to the center. And, you know, I think in this case, it could just be the pendulum swinging too far to the left. And now even, you know, the college professors who themselves were the super liberals in the, you know, 60s and 70s are now the conservatives, wondering what these kids are getting up to these days and fretting about it. In a way, they've kind of brought it on themselves by going too far to the left. I think that kind of corrective is what we're going to see happen now, hopefully. You know, it's like student protests. You know, there's a webpage called thedemands.org.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, it's incredible. the most encouraging thing was one of these college professors, I think it was at Rutgers, the students protested and took over the administration building, or they were having a sit-in or some such thing. And he basically said, if you're not out of here by 5 o'clock tomorrow morning, you'll be arrested and kicked out of college. Oh, that took care of that. You know, you can only tolerate so much of that stuff. And, you know, the disinvitations of people like Ian Hersey Alley and Bill Maher. I mean, these are both, you know, uber liberal people. And even they're, getting disinvited. And yesterday, Madeleine Albright gave the keynote speech or the commencement speech at Scripps College. Scripps College is all women's college here out in the Claremont Colleges in Southern California. And, you know, if you recall, she was Secretary of State, the first woman Secretary of State we've ever had. Under Clinton, I mean, her bona fides could not be better.
I know.
And they protested her, and a bunch of professors sat in the back and refused to put on their robes. And why? Because she's a war criminal. War criminal? What? And this is the problem. This is why I would never run for president. Everybody hates you. No matter what you do, it's the wrong thing to do. You know, so Clinton doesn't act quick enough in Rwanda, and you know he's criticized for allowing these deaths, so that's he's a war criminal. So then he jumps in Kosovo,
and then we have Black Hawk down because of it.
Or Somalia, right? So you know, what are you doing intervening? Mean the America's not the world's police. Okay, so should I intervene or should I not intervene? Doesn't matter, either way we're gonna criticize you. Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you can't win. So
I mean, he used to get criticized for launching missiles in the training camps for Osama bin Laden.
Yes.
So Clinton used to shoot rockets into his training camps, and everybody bitched at him for it. And then, you know, shortly after he leaves office, the 9/11 happens.
Right. Yes. How come you didn't do something?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. And he actually talked about it on network news and why we're doing it. And everybody didn't think about it, didn't talk about it. They still don't talk about it. And it baffles me. But all right. Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, and if you look back at the past of presidential elections alone, we'll tell you that it's never been any different. Worse in the past, actually. So.
Yeah.
I saw somewhere online somebody was trying to like make the claim that you are a diehard Trump supporter just because you mentioned the fact that you appreciated his tactics because he's doing well for doing the thing that everybody's been saying forever you should never do.
Right.
And now you're a supporter of his.
Yeah, that's why I pretty much stay out of politics. It's such a nasty business. Just, you know, not my thing. Hitchens was much better at this than I'll ever be. you gotta stick to your specialties, and so that's what I do.
Yeah, so I assume that you're not in favor of Trump having this finger on the button.
Probably not. That would probably not be a good idea. Although, you know, I'm not a big Hillary supporter either. I mean, she's, even most of my liberal friends are not crazy about her either.
I know. And
Bernie's too far to the left. I know a lot of my friends are saying they're just not going to vote this year.
Yeah, well, that's a bad idea. Because, you know, every time I get into top politics on the show, quite a few people are like, well, you're a science show, not a political show. But I have to remind people that science and politics are, you can't ignore the fact that they are intertwined to the hilt. And
yeah, absolutely. That's very true.
And if people have a doubt about this, just look up at what Canada did under Harper until recently with muscling all the scientists.
Oh, yes, right.
So if somebody tells me that politics and science don't, you know, mix, I'm sorry, but you better be paying attention to the politics if you like science, because half of our science comes after because of the government funding, the laws they make, the bans, the stupid ideas they come up with. That's all the government. And science does not flourish unless the government is on its side.
That's true.
So we started this whole thing with the wrap up of the 25-25 conference, and you talked about your science salon. So I was going to ask you when your next big Science Skeptic Society conference is going to be.
Well, we don't have anything scheduled at the moment. There's you know, Caltech didn't renew our contract for this year. Oh. We might go back there next year. We'll see. But also conferences are hugely time consuming and energy consuming projects to put on. They don't make much money, if at all. And there's so many other good conferences out there that people are doing. You know, this weekend is the New York.
Yeah.
Nexus. Yeah. You know, that's a good conference. And next weekend is the Imagine No Religion conference. And, you know, there's just tons of them. It seems like every couple of weeks there's a great conference going on. So I'm not sure that it's even needed.
Yeah.
And you know, we've done a dozen of these conferences since the early 90s. And, you know, I'm kind of burnt out, to be honest. I'm okay letting other people do it. And just we're just doing our thing. You know, our little science salon, you know, they're live streamed. They're posted online for free to watch later. And you know, that's you know, just there's just different avenues for, you know, science education and critical thinking promotion that we're doing. And, you know, I'll just let other people do conferences. You know, there's lots of good skeptics, a lot of good people that are good at this stuff. You know, that's the encouraging thing, that, you know, in my own career time here, is the growth of the skeptical movement. It's just, it's huge now, and there's just tons of groups and publications and blogs and podcasts and YouTube videos and you know, just so many people doing so many different channels of critical thinking and skepticism that you know, it's like it's really encouraging. That must mean there's a market for it. People really want to know.
Yeah.
What the explanations are for things, and that's what we're doing. And you know, it's almost a branch of science in a way, because mainstream scientists don't have time to invest in providing explanations for these different claims. So that's our job. And, you know, it used to be a fringe thing, and now it's more mainstream. You know, that I've had my column now in Scientific American called Skeptic for 185 consecutive months, you know, going all the way back to 2001. So April of 2001. So when I get to April of 2025, I'll have 300. If I can make it, if they'll let me do it.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, isn't it?
And I'm trying to beat Stephen Jay Gould's record of 300 consecutive monthly columns in Natural History Magazine. So we'll see if I make it.
See if you don't get burned out by then.
Well, I won't get burned out. There's I love writing, and there's plenty of subjects. Like, I just wrote another one on facilitated communication.
Oh, geez.
Making a comeback.
Oh, everything makes a cup out. That's the sad part, isn't it?
It is, and this was triggered by a commercial an Apple Computers commercial for an iPad that's been adapted to use for autistic children who can't communicate. And they, you know, they type, but when you see the commercial, you see the facilitator sitting there kind of holding the iPad, moving it around in space while the kid's trying to, you know, type, sort of, kind of. And then all of a sudden it cuts to this sweet boy graduating from middle school, giving the speech, the commencement speech, or the, you know, valedictorian speech, you know, through his iPad. It's like, oh boy, here we go again. You know, I mean, this has been I hadn't looked at this stuff in years. So I look it up, and sure enough, it's still Syracuse University and Douglas Bicklin, same people.
Yeah.
You know, completely debunked in the 90s, and they're still doing it. I thought for sure they must have, you know, just sort of morphed into doing something else and dropped it. But no, it's still going.
You wait long enough, and everybody will forget.
I guess so.
Well, look, like I said, when Clinton told everybody why he was bombing the desert, it wasn't a couple of years after he left office, people forget that that's what he was doing, to kill the guy we were going after for many years until Obama finally got him.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it doesn't take long before people forget these things.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah, people have short memories. It's like, you know, Randy debunked Peter Popoff. Oh. He's still on the air. I still see him late at night when I'm channel surfing.
I know.
Just looking as goofy as ever and begging for money, and it's pathetic.
Yeah. It's just, you just got to go, what? It's just funny. That's why our job will never be done.
That's right. Yep. You almost hate to say it. the world is always going to need skepticism, but that's true in any case, because there's always controversial ideas, that people don't want to accept, and not just psychic stuff or whatever, but like global warming. There's still people denying global warming. Okay, so what are we going to do about it? And how do we change people's minds? And so that's shows you that it's what we're doing is important, because those are important ideas.
I guess you might have things to do. You said you were working on another book.
Yeah, that and of course editing more issues of Skeptic Magazine. I'm working on an article now on editing an article on paleo diets.
Oh boy,
but yet another one of these fad things.
It's been around for a while, and
oh yeah, but it keeps coming back.
I'm good with that, but I don't think people understand what word paleo really means, because if you look up what you would actually be eating, I don't think anybody would be on that diet.
No, I mean, a lot of it is not tasty, not good. Probably a lot of it's not healthy.
Yeah, and all before our brains got bigger.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you look at what just the gruel that people had to eat before the modern world, I mean, it's just yuck.
I know.
And another one of these sort of utopian fantasies that I'm reading about is the fantasies people had about food.
Yeah.
We don't have those fantasies anymore. We have great food. It's super cheap, far too available for my waistline. And also like this misnomer. What does paleo even mean? What did our Paleolithic ancestors eat? Anything they could find.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I tell people all the time, if you really want an example of what it would be like without, grocery stores and how we eat now, there's a great example of it. Go watch Naked and Afraid.
What's that? I don't know that.
Oh, really? It's a show where they drop a man and a woman naked in some remote place in the world.
Oh,
and
wow.
They give them a map, and they say, in 15 days, come here, we'll pick you up.
Oh, boy.
And all they get is, one item they get to bring. So usually they bring a knife, and somebody brings it can't be modern stuff, so it can be a flint. So that's all they get. So you watch these people, and they all become skeletal within 15 days because they can't find food.
Right.
This is what our ancestors ate. So watch that show, right? Because that is reality of what happens when you take a person without food, the food they would actually get based on our paleo ancestors, and see what it's like. Because there's an example of it right there. You can watch it on TV. And my gosh, things that these people get, like bot flies, and get poisoned by crazy things that, people have not seen for years, because that's what it'd be like. So I'm sorry. Take your diet and shove it.
Yeah.
I know what it looks like. I can see it on TV. I don't want anything to do with that.
No, you would not want to. There's pretty much no time in the past when you'd want to live. It might be fun to go back for a couple hours just to see, but you wouldn't want to spend much time at all. If nothing else, the dentistry and medicine. If anything goes wrong, you are totally screwed.
Oh, yeah. Well, even that, it doesn't take that long in the past to realize this. Just look at, the way people used to, eat and cook back in the 40s even.
Yeah, you're right.
In the 50s even. I mean, before the modern style of a kitchen didn't really come around until the mid 60s. So if you look even before that, and that's I have friends who are old enough to live through that. Okay? So it's not that long ago.
Right.
And even then, compared to today, I don't think you wouldn't eat that way.
No.
So, there was a thing called the TV dinner, which was actually a common thing because that's how people had to eat.
Yep.
Because otherwise, it cost too much money.
Yep.
So
now food is so cheap, and even when it's not, something like Whole Foods, they've been slammed financially. So now they're opening up their 365 stores that are going to be half the price of the normal Whole Foods prices. So it's more affordable.
Yeah.
So it's just, again, it just, the quality keeps going up, the prices keep coming down relative to incomes, and you know, all of us are wealthier because of it, just in terms of, you know, standard of living keeps going up. And you know, you look at a picture of, I have this picture of King Louis the 15th or 14th, when the Sun King, the 14th, you know, and he had like 273 servants, you know, at his beck and call at any time. Well, you and I have thousands of servants, you know. Yeah. I have a barista down at the local Starbucks just waiting for me to come in.
And an app on my phone so I can actually order my coffee before I get there.
You do?
Yes.
I didn't even know I could do that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, go grab the app. You can do it.
Okay. Well, maybe that takes more time than actually just. Okay. There's a local Starbucks here. They're going to have a drive-through, you know, because who wants to get out of a car?
Oh, we have. There's two Starbucks I can like almost walk to, and they both have a drive-through.
They do?
Yeah.
That's too funny.
And I live in a like 30 minutes from the city, out in the suburbs, right. And I still have that.
Yeah. So life is better. Yeah. You know, that's progress. So we're getting there.
Yeah.
All right, Derek. Well, it's been fun talking to you.
Yeah.
Fun stuff, and we'll do it again next year when the Heavens on Earth book comes out. We'll do another
definitely
conversation.
I'm about to say, let's try to make it less than a year.
Yeah, okay, sure, that's fine.
Because, you know, this last time has been more than a year, so.
And thank you for doing this. I mean, you're again one of the things I was talking about, of all the different avenues now of promoting skepticism. Yours is one of the important ones. I appreciate that. All right, well, we'll talk to you soon.
Will do.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks again, Michael. I hope I didn't take too much of your time away from writing your next book. So keep in mind that you can always find out more about the stuff you heard here on this episode, and most of the others as well. You might already know this, but all you have to do is go to www.skepticality.com and head over. You'll find show notes for this episode and all the others.